I want to thank all the labor unions here in Dane County that help keep SlysOffice.com up and going so you keep up to date, whether it be the Madison Firefighters, Local 311, or the Madison Teamsters, Local 695, or our friends at Madison Teachers Incorporated. These are some of the most active local unions who organize, and constantly stand up for workers. Thank you from SlysOffice.com. Welcome to another podcast at SlysOffice.com, brought to you by our friends at Madison Computer Works and Jeff's Guitar Clinic in Fort Atkinson. Joining us now, Dane County District Attorney, my friend, Ish Ozan. Ish, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
So it's been a while since we've spoken. Let me try to get an overview of, in your relationship with what you've asked for from the state with more district attorneys, what has happened with that?
Well, Dane County has not received any new positions. Since I took office in 2010, each biennium since then, I've asked for basically 12 new prosecutors to do coverage of the courts, but also look at community prosecutors, if possible, any number of other innovations we could do. But I have not gotten any traction. The nice thing about this biennium, at least, they have not said that they will fund all 100 or 128 requested positions by elected district attorneys across the state, but they've actually acknowledged the issue, and they are putting 30 prosecutors out statewide in different offices. At least that's what's proposed. But there is nothing for Dane or Milwaukee, your two largest counties, and arguably the ones with the most volume.
Did the governor put something in his budget?
The governor, I believe, did have positions in his budget. I don't know if they were the same as those that the Republicans put forward in their proposal. But either way, at least now it's acknowledged, and hopefully at least in the next biennium, Milwaukee and Dane and the rest of the counties that did not get any new resources now will get some.
You told me when you first took office, former District Attorney Jerry Lynch stopped by and stopped by. He's passed on since. Did they have that kind of problem back in the 70s where we didn't have enough district attorneys? Has this been an ongoing problem for a long time?
Well, back in the 70s, we were or would have been county employees. And had we stayed county employees, Milwaukee and Dane, we would have grown with the population.
Oh.
But in the 90s, the state took over the pay for the attorneys, the prosecutors, because smaller counties, I don't believe, were able to pay a rate that allowed people to actually be a career prosecutor. And the state, and I think under Governor Thompson, said that we believe that that is an important issue and that prosecutors in the state should have experience and expertise.
So that's how this became a problem.
And once we became state employees, then we fell into that pool, and we haven't had really any additions. I think under Doyle, there was maybe 15 prosecutors put into the system at one point in time, but that I can't remember what year that was.
Are you a county employee?
Technically, I'm a state employee, or the state would pay my wage because I'm a constitutional officer. So the state pays the judges and the prosecutor and also now the assistants because they're constitutional officers.
Okay. So with that, you don't have enough prosecutors. You know, the new district attorney in Dallas County in Texas has said they're no longer going to prosecute cases where people are shoplifting for personal needs up to, like, I don't know, $700 or something. I didn't like that idea. Do you ever foresee that having to happen here from lack of prosecutors?
Well, we have always had the discussion about sort of what can we do, what do we need to do. Obviously, the legislature and changed our retail theft statute from $2,500 being the cutoff to make it a felony to down to $500. So you have a whole host of new felonies possibly coming in that are still potentially retail thefts. We haven't gone to say we are across the board not going to prosecute, say, retail thefts. But we look at every option we can to probably try and get people into diversions if possible. Depending on what it is, there's an issue of why are you stealing? Why are you looking to do this behavior. If it's because of addiction, we try and connect you to services either through drug diversion court or drug court, or even our diversion program that deals with opiates.
Whatever move you make, it has a consequence, though, because if you were to not charge shoplifters and that became rampant, you'd run stores out of business that service communities that sometimes have a difficult time getting groceries and food deserts and that sort of thing as well. So it's a complicated situation.
It's probably actually a little more complicated than that, because of technology and because of resources that stores have put in. A lot of big box stores, very few people who are caught and brought to us have even gotten out of sort of the parking lot. They are, you know, noticed for their behavior,
right,
and reached at the last point of payment. So the store actually hasn't lost the merchandise many times, and that doesn't say that it doesn't happen, and we do try and address that, but it is a little more complicated.
So what do you make of the whole debate over the Dane County Jail?
Well, what I believe is this. I believe the facility that we have that the sheriff needs to take offline, it's the top two floors of the city-county building, need to be redone. I don't believe we can treat people humanely in those facilities, in that facility, because it's more of a segregation sort of situation. And because of the issues that we're dealing with mental health, with addictions, we need a humane facility to actually treat people with what the sheriff has to deal with. I think if we don't agree that we're going to build a new jail now and make it a humane facility, we will build a new jail. We'll do it under litigation because something bad will happen and we will be forced to take that offline and put a new facility in place. But when we built the public safety building, these issues weren't on people's minds because we didn't have people with mental health being funneled into the criminal justice system. They were still being funneled into the mental health system within, say, Mendota or other facilities that were caring for them in a humane way.
It's such a interesting paradox, though, because you've got Dylan Brogan writing that piece in the Isthmus talking about the lead in the water and the asbestos and the terrible conditions, you know, the conditions you'd find in Alabama someplace. And yet you have activists in this community that feel so strongly about incarceration being a negative and the justice system being racist that the very notion of building a new jail is somehow more negative than the current conditions of the Dane County Jail. And I guess I'm a little surprised by that.
Well, if your thought process is that we're going to build a new facility, a new building with more capacity and maybe not take off the old facility, then you might think that this complex of building incarceration facilities is just going to keep ramping up and growing. I think in Dane County, at least with Sheriff Mahoney and even prior to him, some of the sheriffs we've had, their attempts to look at how to get people out of jail. But Sheriff Mahoney, for sure, with his STAR and CAMP programs to get people out into their homes on home arrest with GPS monitoring and sobrieters, has proven that he is not looking to lock more people up. He is looking to treat people with dignity and respect, as well as hopefully make it a place where, yes, they're held accountable, but in a way that actually benefits the community.
Okay, but my family moved here from Milwaukee in 1965. Dane County's doubled in size since then. So that has to be part of the equation, you know?
It definitely does. But if we look at sort of how we're actually treating people, if we can get to the root causes, this shows also in this idea that, you know what, when we have people coming in with addictions to opiates, we know that if we can get them treatment, if we can get them with tools to fight that addiction, we're likely to affect that criminal behavior and we're likely not to see that criminal behavior. So we may not need to say we need a one-for-one bed. And I know that the jail plan right now actually brings the total number of beds available to the sheriff down by at least 100.
You sent me some information that I haven't really had a chance to peruse yet. Tell me about the Red Hook Community Justice Center in Brooklyn.
Well, you know, it's... I would say not rocket science. What they said is, listen, let's look at a new way to deal with people that are coming to the system, because you know what? They are our citizens before they commit a crime. They are our citizens after they've committed a crime, and they are our citizens once they get off of supervision, potentially. And let's look at how we're treating them. Let's look at if we can give them the resources they need to hopefully change their life, to actually make them a better part of the community, and look at what this community really needs. And they actually were able to turn Red Hook around. It's a community in New York that at one point was dubbed the most dangerous place in the country. And they have totally changed that neighborhood. They have changed it for recidivism, for new crimes. It is a different place than it used to be, and it is seeing a regeneration. So I would.
What
would
are some of the things that they've done that are different?
I think what they do is they don't have your traditional courtroom. The judge is actually operating within what we have is our specialty courts, or our drug court, our OWI court. What some people would consider a mental health court would be where the judge is more on a one-to-one footing with the participant or the quote-unquote defendant. They're looking at needs. They're looking at getting them into counseling, looking at making sure that they actually build more of a relationship with the criminal justice system and that participant, and really addressing their needs, showing that, yes, you know what, we're going to actually do a little more wraparound with you and try and make sure that you have what you need to actually get back on your feet. And it's shown huge benefits. Judge Calabresi, who is the judge who oversees the Red Hook Community Justice Center, actually came to Dane County, presented to the county board. When I learned about Red Hook and saw it, was like, this is incredible. This is something that could benefit every community, but how can we implement it here in Dane County? In Red Hook in New York, they have isolated neighborhoods that are either isolated by geographics. They have a stable population because New York is the largest landlord in the state, and people take 10 years to get into, you know, government housing, and then they stay there for generations. So they have more of a stable community. We are more fluid.
Very transient. Yeah.
So we couldn't necessarily take a judge out of our courthouse and put it in, let's say, Sun Prairie or Stoughton. There's just too many moving parts. But if we could bring this community justice center to the courthouse, and now that we're going to commit $140, $150 million to a new jail, if we look at over these next 5 years committing to making a community justice center in and around that jail, we could affect the criminal justice system in Dane County top to bottom and actually have the impacts, I believe, that we're seeing, they saw in Red Hook and that they're experiencing here in Dane County for the whole county, the whole criminal justice system.
You know, in the most recent mayor's race, there was a real divide between Mayor Soglin and former alder, now Mayor Satya Rhodes Conway, when the question was asked, is Madison a racist city? And she said, yes, Madison is a racist city. We live in a racist country. Mayor Soglin took umbrage at that. When you talk about dealing with criminal justice system, and you've seen the numbers on incarceration and arrests of African-Americans versus Caucasians, what do you think about what Satya said? And do you think Madison is a racist city?
Well, when you look at your systems, I mean, can you walk up to somebody on the street and say you're a racist? I don't think you can say you're a racist. You don't know that person.
You never met my uncle.
But can you? Well, but if you met your uncle would have given you information and given you his opinions. And yes, maybe you could have said, yes, you're a racist. Is there institutional racism within our system? Yes. Within our country? Yes. Within our community? We can't say that there isn't, because we look at the impact of the criminal justice system on certain populations. That said, can you say to Madisonians, all of you are racist? I don't think you can say that, but you can say, listen, there are impacts that are impacting different portions of our population, and if we don't recognize that and call it what it is, then we are doing ourselves a disservice. We're a little different than, say, Milwaukee or Chicago. You could move through our community from your home to your work to shop to back home and not run through our communities of poverty or our at-risk areas where you're confronted with poverty. If you go downtown, maybe you'll see some panhandlers. Now, if you drive past the mall, maybe you'll see some people on the corners asking for change, you know, those sort of things. But you're not confronted with it like, say, in Milwaukee or Chicago, where it's just so present. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. You know, we've created great new road projects, allows you or I to travel through areas where we might see pockets of poverty, but now we no longer have to because they're moving traffic through there with an ability for the populace to move under the roads or through ways that they don't have to interact with everyone else. And that's not necessarily a service. It's somewhat of a disservice because we could operate in this community and say we don't have these issues. The credit of this community is this, though. I think to a one of us, we've said, listen, we recognize there is a problem, and we're not willing to say that, you know what, we are going to live in this community with our eyes closed. Let's get to the table. Let's actually talk about solutions, and let's try and make this a better place for everybody.
We will pick it up from there. We're talking to Dane County District Attorney Ishmael Ozan at slysoffice.com.
Similar to a well-tuned automobile, a guitar requires the same level of attention to perform at its very best. No matter how expensive your guitar may be, we will treat you and your instrument with the utmost respect. Call 920-723-1733 or visit jeffsguitar.com. Jeff's Guitar Clinic in Fort Atkinson, we love guitars.
We're back at slysoffice.com, brought to you by our friends at Madison Firefighters Local 311, Madison Teachers Incorporated, and Madison Teamsters Local 695. Ish Ozan with us. He has been Dane County's district attorney since 2010. He worked for the Department of Corrections before that and worked at the Dane County District Attorney's Office before that, starting in 1998. One of my other jobs is working at WIBA-FM. The other day, we had one of our contestants to win a boat was former Dane County Sheriff Rick Ramish and former Dane County District Attorney and former Department of Corrections Secretary Rick Ramish. He is back from Colorado.
Yes.
Have you talked to him since he's been back?
No, not yet. I was waiting for him to get settled, but yes, I will be hopefully reaching out and connecting with him soon. He's been all over the place, all over the world, talking about getting rid of solitary confinement, talking about treating people who we are punishing humanely. And that's really what we all have to do, because when we punish somebody by taking their liberty, we take on the responsibility for their care, and we should not be making them worse and putting people with mental health issues in solitary confinement, putting healthy people in solitary confinement does them no good. And Secretary Ramish did an incredible thing when he was running the Colorado prison system. He actually asked to experience solitary confinement. And then he wrote an article about that. And that has taken him all over the world to actually talk to different systems, to talk to people at the UN about truly treating people humanely so that we can actually make our communities safer.
I can tell you this. He's not a Republican anymore. he was a pretty progressive guy always. I was wondering, and I asked him about the whole Colorado experiment with legalizing marijuana. And he gave me a very honest assessment. And in the end, he kind of said, this is the way it's going to be from now on. There's good and there's bad. What are your thoughts about legalizing marijuana in Wisconsin?
Well, I think this. The only way government has ever sort of controlled or regulated anything is to legalize it and then tax it and regulate it. That's just the reality. Look at alcohol. What did we do when we went into prohibition? We gave, in a sense, organized crime an ability to have an unfettered stream of income.
Yes, my grandparents were criminals going to speakeasies.
So those are the real issues that we actually have to address. And I think the reality is, you know, if the legislature wants to address this and wants to truly regulate controlled substances, then we're going to have to figure out a way for them to bring them under the government's control. And that would likely mean legalizing them in some fashion and actually controlling their distribution and their levels. What frightens me, at least at this point, is not necessarily saying someone is smoking a joint or something like that. It's, frankly, the edibles and the fact that they look like gummy bears or all of these other candies, and those getting into the hands of kids either in elementary school, middle school, that have no idea what it is they're eating and consuming that and then having medical issues because
of it. Yeah, I noticed Ontario, you know, Canada has just legalized marijuana, and Ontario is putting a far tighter regulation on edibles, and they aren't going to make edibles that look like candy in that country, or at least in Ontario. So I don't know, maybe we will learn from some of the other states that have legalized it, but as long as the Republicans control the legislature, it's probably a moot point. I want to talk to you a little bit about what happened earlier this year and last year with the police chief and his concern about teens stealing cars and recidivism and teens stealing cars literally with ankle bracelets. Dane County judges got very defensive about this, and I'm wondering what your thoughts about the whole situation is with teens stealing cars, and did the police chief have a valid concern?
I think law enforcement, I think the community, I think all of us have a valid concern when we talk about safety of our community, safety on our roads. And I think the real scary part of this is that some of the message we believe the teens are getting, or at least some of the teens, is that the system isn't going to hold me accountable, and therefore I'm free to just continue to do what it is that I want to do or what I was doing. I think we, as a community, have to ask ourselves, did we miss an opportunity? And I think for most of these kids who are running rampant, if would be the easiest way to say it, we likely missed an opportunity well into their youth before they became juvenile delinquents or before they entered the juvenile justice system. And for many, when we start looking, and I can't tell you for certain because these aren't our records, but when we try and look back at some of these that we call repeat offenders, we're seeing contacts with human services where we hopefully could have had a positive intervention within that child's life or that family. And if we can shift some of our workload, human services already has 51% of our operating budget. And last time I looked a number of years ago, that was 260 some million plus, right? If we could try and apply some of those resources when these kids are between 8 and 10 or even before, we might have a whole different situation because they may never come into the juvenile justice system at 12, 13, 14, or 16. And then what we're going to have happen now is they're going to fall into the criminal justice system at 17. And these offenses are serious felony offenses. When you talk about burglary, when you talk about stealing a car, when you talk about any number of the activities, reckless endangerment that are happening, when they hit the criminal justice system as an adult, all of those behaviors are going to set up a situation where we're not able to deal with them as a youth. We're going to be talking about incarceration and for how long. And that's what scares me, because we're literally setting these kids up to sort of take from them their liberty for a substantial period of time once they become an adult. And some would argue are not even an adult or not even mature at 17.
So I have never been for charging young people as adults. I just, as a matter of principle, think when you're 18, you're an adult. And yet these are very adult crimes. Going in Grand Theft Auto is an adult crime. Do you have the mechanism to deal with and punish teenagers that are repeatedly stealing automobiles to hold them accountable in some way, shape, or form without sending them to Lincoln Hills or wherever?
Well, some of the structures and the options that courts had, like halfway houses or out-of-home placements, are not as prevalent or non-existent within Dane County anymore. The issues that were at Lincoln Hills may be resolved with bringing detention centers for juveniles closer to home and having regionals, but that isn't going to be in the works for at least another 2 years. I think what we really need to start asking ourselves is, for these kids that we're seeing, you know, many of them are getting their adoration, their kudos, their support from, you know, in a sense, I would say potentially what we would traditionally think of as a gang, right? As a group outside of the organized family structure. And because of that, you know, why would we think that they would change their behavior? We need to set up real opportunities. And one of the biggest things that struck me was when John Bauman, the head of the juvenile detention center, actually asked those he had that he was holding, these juveniles, and I think he, at the point, he might have had between 15 and 20, he said, what do you need? What is it you need in your lives that could hopefully change this? And they actually said they needed adults in their lives that cared about them, that would spend quality time with them, that would give them the support that they want or are seeking other places. So I think I don't want to look at just charging, but when you look at sort of people coming in the juvenile system, law enforcement, and I've applauded them for this, have decided not to pursue through residential areas, through traffic. And I believe that that is the best course for community safety. That said, if we don't catch somebody eluding, and eluding would be an adult jurisdiction offense, if we don't catch somebody in the act of the theft, right, the next thing that we're going to be talking about is you are either joyriding or you're driving in a car without the owner's permission. You're not necessarily, we're not able to prove the actual theft. So what we have and what the system has to address those issues is different depending on what law enforcement is able to prove and refer to us. Now, it doesn't say that the juvenile system doesn't have the ability to address these and we aren't charging them. We are. But because the juvenile system is not meant to hold juveniles for the entirety of their case, potentially, they're getting out. And if they're not getting out to structure, they may get out into the community and continue to do the behavior over and over again until the system catches up to them or until they become an adult.
What happened the other day with the woman being released before a hearing after she was alleged to have evaded police going 110 miles an hour? She was on probation from a 2017 case that was similar. Why was she released without a hearing?
Well, I can't talk about the actual details of an open investigation or potentially open prosecution, but when we review cases, whenever law enforcement either makes an arrest or gets to the point where they think they have enough to charge somebody, they refer those reports to us. We review those reports. At that point in time, we will either believe we have enough to make a decision, a charging decision, or we may ask for follow-up. And if we ask for follow-up, if the person is held, we're not able to have an actual day in court. And so therefore, the person would have a bail hearing and potentially be continued to be held. Or we would have to talk to the court about when we thought we would have a complaint ready. So we basically would say, follow up to law enforcement, courts, please give us another date for this person to appear so that we actually can get the information requested. That's what happened, at least in that case specifically.
When you say you asked for more information, can you tell us what you were asking for?
What I can tell you is that we've asked law enforcement for follow-up. And that can be any number of things. Now, obviously, there are multiple jurisdictions that were involved in that actual situation. We need to make sure that we have everything we believe we need to make an accurate charging decision. Now, that could be on the actual charge that was referred. We can actually look at things and say, you know what, we believe that there's another offense. So we could actually look at law enforcement referring one charge to us, and we actually turned that into three, because we believe the elements for the different offenses were there. Or they could send three and we say, you know what, we only believe we have enough for one and this is what we're going with. But typically what you're seeing is us making sure that we have everything we need to move forward before we do.
You know, Tony Galley's very good at painting a interesting picture with his reports. Evidently, this woman had had a number of contacts with law enforcement in between the time she was put on probation and when this other incident happened, where she's alleged to have evaded the police. What does the Department of Corrections do? Are they not responsible for her probation and revoking it if she's violating the law in between?
Well, the Department of Corrections supervises any number of people, and I don't know the specifics of this person that you're referencing. But typically what would happen is if law enforcement believes someone is violating a law, they would alert the agent and the agent would put a hold on them. The agent would then make a decision as to what the behavior was, what's the dangerousness, and then maybe make a decision to start revocation processes. If they did that, there would be a hold placed on the individual. I don't know that person's supervision status, so I couldn't venture to guess what the Department of Corrections was or was not doing. If there's not a hold either, I'm assuming that the information that they had at the time wasn't enough, or that they are still in their process because they have a time in which to make these decisions as well.
Are you concerned there was any police misconduct in the arrest?
I have not had any information about that at all. No. So you know, I know it's a very serious situation. I can say that I think police take these cases very seriously. And, you know, there's any number of cases that we ask for follow-up. So this is not something that's out of routine.
Have you taken a stand at all? I'm going to ask you one more question. Mm-hmm. Have you taken a stand at all? What do you think about having police officers in schools?
You know, I think what you probably need to actually do is get some of those EROs in and actually talk to them. Because I think the community, I get when we were in school and when I was in high school, we didn't have officers in the schools. And when officers came to the school.
Go to West?
I went to West.
All right. I went to Memorial.
And so my wife went to Memorial as well. But we didn't have officers in school. When officers were brought to school, it was usually because there was a disturbance or an issue. Officers came in, assessed the situation, and likely took somebody out of the school. I think EROs have a different relationship with the student body, with the school itself, and with law enforcement. And I think if you actually really looked at what they do on a daily basis, I think they actually keep a lot more kids out of the system than actually putting them into the system. Because you know what? They might walk into a disturbance in the cafeteria and say, whoa, whoa, hey, I know all of you. I need you two to sit over here till I can talk to you. You guys go back to class, and we're not going to have this versus right. Officer walks in, does not know anybody, says, you six are involved, everyone on the floor, and we're figuring out who we're taking out right now. And that's because there isn't a relationship. They don't know them. And I think we actually really probably should talk to the EROs. I think there is a discussion as to should the school have some ability to talk about who they want as an ERO? Yes. But I understand where the police are saying, listen, you can't tell us who to place into a position. But I think there's a discussion, and I don't think law enforcement wants to put an officer into the school that the school doesn't like or that is going to have more issues than say, another officer. But they are very important. If you look at Officer Rossetti, who was the school officer for La Follette, if he wasn't there, we likely wouldn't have had teen courts as a model here. I mean, his ability to interact with the students, with the administration, with law enforcement, with the community, allowed really that school's teen court to become a model right. for all the rest.
Right. Thanks for coming on. I should ask you before you go, have you made an endorsement for next year's Supreme Court race?
I have. Jill Karofsky is the candidate that I have endorsed. I've known Jill Karofsky actually since I became an assistant. She was part of the management team in the Dane County District Attorney's Office that hired me, that helped train me as a prosecutor. And I have always enjoyed her as one, as a supervisor, as well as seeing her in her different positions where she is actually was with the Department of Justice as the sort of head of victim services, and seeing her as a judge, seeing how she interacts with the community, how she treats offenders with mm-hmm. dignity and respect, as well as victims and their families. I think that she would be an asset to the court and truly would look at issues in a nonpartisan way.
Separate issue. Josh Call endorsed Marcy's Law. And I have a real problem with Marcy's Law on a number of fronts. Have you thought about Marcy's Law coming to Wisconsin?
Marcy's Law, here's what you need to understand. Wisconsin was one of the first, is, I think, the first place in the nation to have a victim's bill of rights for adults and juveniles. The services that we provide already are incredible for victims. The fact that we are looking to make sure that they actually have a voice in the courtroom and have an ability to speak to the judge and have their rights considered at every point, you know, we're already doing these things. I understand why Marcy's Law looked at Wisconsin and said, we need to go there because of the groundwork we already created. Do I think that Marcy's Law is a bad thing? I don't think giving victims more rights is a bad thing per se, but I think we need to make sure that we aren't going to impact the system differently and possibly make things worse because of
Well, criminal defense attorneys tell me they're very concerned about the Sixth Amendment and their right to interrogate somebody who's been a witness in a situation or interrogate the person making the charge.
Well, the reality is this. No one has to communicate to you or I. And we have to tell victims or witnesses that, you know, they could decide not to talk to us for trial prep or defense attorneys. They don't have to talk to anybody. You know, the system doesn't work unless people cooperate, unless people report mm-hmm. to the police, unless people are willing to take time out of their life to actually come to court and testify. It would fall apart. But we can't force anybody to necessarily talk to us or the other side.
Isho Zan, Dane County District Attorney, thanks for coming to SliceOffice.com.
Thank you so much for having
Appreciate
me.
Appreciate it.
SliceOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.